on flashpoints. Threats made against Jewish community centers in at least 11 states as hundreds of grave sites were defaced or completely destroyed yesterday in Philadelphia. I think over 500. The Philadelphia attack comes less than a week after a similar attack in St. Louis. Also, we'll feature excerpts from a new speech by Michael Eric Dyson, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're expecting a visit by Rabbi Michael Lerner of Tikkun to talk about these attacks, but he is not here. This is a live broadcast, so we have to move on. I want to share with you now some excerpts from a mighty powerful speech given last week, I believe, or this week, very recent, by Michael Eric Dyson, called Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America.
But what an honor it is to be here tonight in the midst of this extraordinary season that we are presently enduring. It is indeed one of the most unique moments in the history of American society. Unique not because of the extraordinary convergence of opportunity and democratic energy, not because someone has been seized by an extraordinary conception of the liberty and equality that should characterize the American dream. It is an extraordinary moment because we have been besieged by a kleptocracy and a baronocracy of tycoons who rule and reign in positions of authority for which they are not suitably fit, and when we think of the extraordinary capacity of the figure who did run and received more than 3 million more votes than the person that she put down in the popular election, so that no populism can be had by a person who loses by nearly 3 million votes, to claim a mandate to reorganize in radical fashion the very tenets of American government without any sense of what that might mean in the ultimate sense of great statesmanship. Even if we were to concede the legitimacy of the presidency to a person who attacked the legitimacy of a man who occupied that office for 2 years, the relentless velocity of assault upon a man manifestly superior in every regard and ain't nobody perfect. We not trying to elect no Messiah. But in retrospect, what we had is a lot better than what we got. And here we are living in a time where the vicious premises of autocratic, authoritarian, crypto-fascist, neo-totalitarian impulses. And I know it sounds hyperbolic. I know it sounds like I've extended the thesaurus to embrace a figure of such pitiful imagination. Here, the man who occupied that office before him was being interviewed in the New York Times about the books that infused his spirit and inspired his mind. At length, he discoursed about the convergence of literatures and genres that occupied his imagination to imagine a sitting president thinking critically about literary art and the art forms and inviting five of his favorite novelists to the White House, including Juno Diaz and local homeboy sensation Dave Eggers. And then to imagine science fiction and the literary craft that was being practiced so that Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln were smiling because now their dark child, this sun-kissed, ebony-embraced child of our colossal American imagination, despite the colonial impulse that denied the legitimacy of his own standing, and a hack who assaulted him as not being worthy, attacked his grades and attacked his legitimacy, tried to retroactively abort him from the womb of American democracy, denying him the breathing, living embodiment of the greatness he possessed. And we have gone from that to a tweeting chief. Vengeful, nasty, bitter, reactionary, thin-skinned. This is not simply about left versus right, though that would be a great place to start. This is about imagining the possibility of filling an office of the most important magnitude with a pitifully shrunken consciousness that is reduced to 25 words, the most likely of which are huge and great. These stark adjectives that lack the velocity of nouns and the power of verbs and gerunds and dangling participles and grammar that is constructed in a complicated fashion. We have gone from chess to pinochle. And it has been well remarked on that we are living through what Hannah Arendt talked about in terms of a totalitarian impulse. Yes, it seems hyperbolic. We are generating these words and sentences to somehow delineate what's going on, to denominate what we see before us, to accurately capture the colossal magnitude and depth of the horror to which we have descended. Not even being able to imagine this man as chief of anything, but especially of the United States of America. Where even if you disagree with somebody, dignity and aplomb might characterize them, this man has made us, even on the outskirts of the impossible, nostalgic for George W. Bush. Not gonna do it, the old man said. And now here we are, as he has gathered unto himself a cabinet of people who are equally incompetent. The Peter principle has been exhausted. And it has been mostly the ruin and reign of white men who are rich. I ain't got nothing against white men who are rich, especially those with a conscience. There are many of them, but they are not in his cabinet. The women, too. Here we are having Vice President Pence break the tie today to put in a woman who has the potential to subvert the beauty and the edifying capacity of education to inform all of our children and to reach broadly across the American landscape and horizon to include all of our children. We have put in a fascist, in the worst sense of that word, to also dictate from the top educational policy and at HUD, and he has included a brother and some women. The soft bigotry of bro expectations. And in the aftermath of that, we are left to wonder where we are today. But one of the resources that has not been taken into consideration is that this is a crisis of whiteness. Because you see, not just any kind of whiteness. I don't mean the white brothers and sisters who sit here with eager ears to imbibe and internalize some redemptive moment that might be able to strike against the empire. I'm talking about whiteness as a metastasizing disease of presumed superiority that now has met its match. I'm talking about the fiction of whiteness, the illusion of whiteness, and whiteness is destroying white people. White brothers and sisters have to surrender their hold on this whiteness, which is destroyed so much before us, because what I mean by whiteness is this concatenation and convergence of spurious ideals and mythologies and assertions of superiority that are manifestly untrue. The burden it takes for white brothers and sisters to carry that. This was said to be a referendum of the white working class. I love the white working class, but Donald Trump ain't your man. Donald Trump ain't gonna look out for you. He ain't even told us how much taxes he paying. You know you got to tell how many taxes you paying. He might be running a shell game. He might not even have no paper. Cash rules everything around me. Got to get the money. Dollar bill, y'all. Cream! It's a Wu-Tang Clan presidency. White working class should be taken seriously, but not by this man, not by this administration. They ain't got nothing for you. They've got top-down policies and hierarchies that will deny you the legitimacy of your access to your Obamacare, because Obamacare. Trump don't care. It ain't called Trump care. Might as well be called Trump don't give a damn. That's what your insurance policy is. Obamacare wasn't perfect. Obama wasn't perfect. He made mistakes. He veered to the right. He was centrist in a way that he shouldn't have been. He didn't call to question many of the policies and presumptions that informed our society, but he was so much better than and superior to what we see now. His ability to motivate human beings to be inspired by higher ideals, not the vicious nastiness of building walls. He wanted to build bridges, not to keep people out. Not to dog people, not to demonize them. It's not the Mexicans or the Puerto Ricans or the Dominicans. It's them damn Republicans. What America do you want to make great again? An America that denied the legitimacy of women? I was in Los Angeles with 750,000 folk, right? And the women's was out there. Women of every stripe. And I tell you what, I know women can be narrow and vindictive and gossipy. I get that. But at the end of the day, they just better than men. I don't want to make no ontological association or a philosophical assertion about the essential and primal differences between men and women. They just better. So my brothers and sisters, here we are now with the ginning up and ratcheting up of this white supremacist nationalist nostalgia for when America was run by a certain kind of person. The white working class thinks that it has found its hero in Donald Trump. He is not your hero. His policies will not serve you. Martin Luther King Jr. was in jail in Birmingham. And his white jailers came to him, and the warden included, and saying, Dr. King, what you're doing is wrong. What you are doing is not righteous, and what you are doing will not lead to justice. In fact, segregation is right. And Dr. King said, no, that's not true. But then he asked them, how much you making? What's your livelihood? What kind of insurance you got? And when they finished telling him, he was like, well, hell, you need to go out here and march with us. Because he understood that white brothers and sisters were being beat down too. But W.E.B. Du Bois said that white brothers and sisters who are poor are sold the psychic wages of whiteness. Which means at least you ain't a nigger. At least you're not down on the bottom. At least you are not the dregs of the earth. At least you have not descended into what John Bunyan called the slough of despond. At least you ain't there at the bottom working it out. And even if you are suffering, at least you're not a Negro. And the captains of industry and the unprincipled wealthy white people manipulated the racist impulse of the white working class to prevent them from forging solidarity with black and brown and red and yellow working class people. Because the truth is, we got much more in common. The thing is that all the white folk who voted for Donald Trump gonna lose their insurance. This administration has no investment in you, doesn't understand what your children are up against. He wants to send the federal agents into Chicago. Oh, right. You want to exacerbate a tinderbox over there, to mix metaphors. You want to blow that stuff up. And then when the federal agents go in, you know they ain't gonna make no distinctions between the so-called criminals and those who ain't. So they begin to terrorize those people who are already being terrorized by urban crime. And on top of that, I thought that they were about states' rights, these right-wingers and Republicans. Why is it now that you're not acknowledging the legitimacy of the state to defend itself and the city to take care of its business? And one of the things white brothers and sisters say to me all the time, I was debating Rudy Giuliani on Meet the Press, and he was saying, look, we shouldn't be talking about the minuscule number of black people who die at the hands of the police. He said, we should talk about the thousands of black people who die at the hands of other black folk. All right, let's try to be legitimate in terms of our philosophical argument about empirical verification of facts. Because, you know, they don't believe in facts over on that side. They are post-fact, post-truth. They into alternative facts because they're in alternative universes. I don't know what planet they living on. But let's acknowledge it. 93% of black people who are killed by black people. That's true. But 84% of white folk who are killed by white people. Ain't nobody going around talking about, oh my God, Jiminy Cricket. What are we gonna do? The white family is going to hell in a handbasket? And Miley Cyrus is leading the call? Twerk, twerk, Miley. Miley, Miley, twerk. There is no language for white pathology. There is no language for the inability of white people to muster the moral strength to keep at bay the absurd forces that would destroy them, because there is no conception of whiteness as intellectually inclined to be self-destructive, nor is there an ethical autopsy of the corroding corpse of white identity. But there is for black and brown people, for red and yellow people, for indigenous people, which is why we can step a pipeline through their own sacred territory, destroying their homeland. And so when we look at it, people kill where they live. Folk kill in the geographical district in which they find themselves segregated. If you want integrated killing, you got to have integrated communities. That was the great dream of Dr. King. I have a dream one day that Negroes and whites will be able to kill each other with equal access. Here we are worshiping the Second Amendment with guns. It ain't called a Second Commandment, but people worship at the altar of the gun. And yet, if we take that same logic, how many people been killed by terror in America over the last year since 9/11? Not even 100 and so. How many people are dying at the hands of white on white violence? Thousands per year. So by that logic, why are you concerned about terror in ISIS and Al-Qaeda? It's not Muhammad, it's Billy Bob. Oh, but that will not work. We do not think that white terrorism is equally as opprobrious as so-called Islamic terrorism. All people can take religion and distort it. The greatest forms of terror I've seen in my own life have been exercised by vigilante posses in the name of Jesus and identity by white brothers and sisters who believe in the cross. They burn crosses on people's lawns. And so it's impossible for white brothers and sisters to see that, many of them, with the exception of you who are here. Y'all get it. Because y'all know whiteness is a lie, it's a projection, it's a mythology. Ain't nobody born black or brown or red or yellow or white. These are social inventions, social constructions. These are mythologies. Anthropologists have already told us in a heterosexual paradigm that the very predicate for being called human is the ability to mate with another person. That means everybody who can get down is in the same race. Oh, I like that definition, because we ain't been taught to think about it, that whiteness is a privilege. And a lot of white people say to me, what are you talking about, Mike? You're a rich black professor from Georgetown. Well, I'm a black professor from Georgetown. Okay, maybe. So the reality is, they say, well, my God, I don't have the privilege you have, and I get that. But isn't it interesting? I don't remember that part in White Supremacy and Jim Crow where rich Negroes will be exempt from the rules. I don't remember that part where Jackie Robinson's children didn't have to go to a black school. I didn't remember where Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong were exempt from white supremacy and Jim Crow, that they could stay in a white hotel. Even when they had money, they had the wrong skin. We saw with the president who occupied the Oval Office before this man. He was demonized. The man was talked about like a dog. He was highly intelligent, fluent, and literate. And yet he was not exempt even from the vicious assault of white supremacy. So having some dough doesn't exempt you. And let me tell you, the ultimate white privilege is to interact on a dark night when you're by yourself with a police person and live to tell about it. Now, that doesn't mean that white brothers and sisters should not be addressed in terms of the lack of opportunity that they possess, but don't make it against African American or Latino or indigenous people. That's a false dichotomy. The relief of social suffering according to race will not adequately compensate white people who have been denied because they were not denied because of black or brown or red or yellow people. They were denied because of the infrastructure of inequality that capitalism replicates time and again. And so the division of the races is an extraordinary benefit to those in charge, the Steve Bannons of the world, those who imagine a narrow universe. They mad at the Pope. Bannon is a Catholic, and he's unhooked up with some other folk in Vatican City and in Italy and other places where they're trying to challenge the legitimacy and authority of the Pope. Look how arrogant a certain strain and strand and variety of whiteness is. Like you God, like you in charge, like you gonna unseat the Pope. Thank God for this Pope right here. I love it when they call me Big Pope. And if you don't know, now you know. And so white brothers and sisters don't understand that they possess a race too. And that race has qualifications and characteristics. It's one among many other races. But whiteness has been rendered universal and natural and normal and therefore not seeable. And therefore, many white people see themselves as American and human. And therefore, they get upset with black folk and brown and red and yellow folk. Why are you so obsessed with race? As if it was our choice, as if we were walking down the street. You know, we haven't had enough racial discourse today. And the burden of that race that we bear, what James Baldwin called the burden of representation, many people who don't walk in those shoes don't understand. And so white brothers and sisters who don't have to bear that burden because it is invisible, because their whiteness has not been articulated as one among many ethnicities and races. Oh, it might be an ethnicity. You might be, you know, you might come in from Eastern or Western Europe. You might be Polish or Jewish or Italian or Lithuanian. But you're remade in the crucible of race. It pulverizes ethnic particularity and recreates it as whiteness. How the Irish became white, Noel Ignatieff says, or a book that talks about how the Jews became white. But everybody has been a candidate for that except for people of color, and some more than others. Ain't much I can do with this skin right here. I ain't no candidate. Well, a light-skinned Negro like me might be. On a good day, far away. Not sure if he's Caucasoid or not. Not sure. But you get Denzel with that rich, deep chocolate. I ain't heard nobody complaining about that. A brother Ali up on Moonlight, that handsome chocolateness. Everybody likes chocolate. It's a Reese's Pieces kind of conception of American identity. You got your peanut butter in my chocolate. You got your chocolate in my peanut butter. That black and brown Latino, African American reality, that black reality, that brown reality, that red and yellow, that constitutes the legitimacy of American multiculturalism. And people don't understand that whiteness competes for an understanding of what that might mean, because it feels its own erosion of authority and power. And instead of seeing itself diminished, it ought to see itself enhanced. Think about it. Whiteness left to its own devices does not work well. Babe Ruth didn't play against the best ball players. He played against the best white ball players. Imagine a universe where Steph Curry could not play. A magician of the psychotherapeutic intervention in space and time. An alchemist of the round ball. A figure who understands the spherical object as the articulation of a planetary possibility. He's Einstein in with a jump shot. And you telling me to allow Steph Curry to play is allowing somebody who's inferior? Affirmative action does not mean that people who don't deserve to be there get a shot. It means that those who should have had a shot from the jump get involved. Many white brothers and sisters don't understand. They done had the coldest case of affirmative action ever, because you kept people from competing with you. You got into Harvard against the best white talent, not all talent. And even then, there were great Asian Jews who were locked out. And then later on, Asian brothers and sisters, y'all so against affirmative action, except you got it in California, because the Asians would be whipping your butt all the way. In California, where they began to impose informal tariffs and restrictions on Asian brothers and sisters because they were outperforming white people to an extraordinary degree, that now we have to have some artificial regulator and governor of the access of talent. Otherwise, it would look a lot different than it do be looking now. Oh, because you see, whiteness has been an affirmative action in the worst sense of that word. This administration shows you the worst sense of what affirmative action is. Ain't got no skill. You see, people who are ultimately inferior have to project an air of superiority. I'm huge, I'm huge, I'm huge. It ain't your talk, it's your performance. It ain't what you talking, it's what you doing. It's what you do with what you got. And unfortunately, in this regime, the mendacity and mediocrity have been tethered. That means that you got folk who are fatally incapable of imagining their way out of the predicament and paradoxes in which we discover ourselves. Never forget that that monster was created, however, by the dominant whiteness of our culture. Oh, it's easy now to jump on Donald Trump, but Eric Cantor and John Boehner and Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, oh, you contributed to that too. Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon and the Bushes, you contributed to that too. You assaulted the legitimacy of women's bodies. You attacked black and brown people. You said we were welfare queens. You hammered away at us. Frankenstein is the name of the doctor, not the monster. And the doctor of whiteness has created in the laboratory of its own sick imagination this Trumpian monster. And isn't it interesting that these very white people don't understand, even if you came in 20, 25, 30 years ago, you benefited as a white immigrant from rules and restrictions and regulations that even people of color who've been here for 200-300 years ain't got. You came during restrictive covenants and redlining and steering. You were still the beneficiary of white privilege in the face of Jim Crow. So please don't be that ignorant and fatally narcissistic. Don't live in what Gore Vidal called the United States of amnesia. Claim your membership in the kingdom of memory. And when you do that, we can get rid of the poisonous, toxic, paralyzing form of whiteness. And together we can remake this nation so that e pluribus unum, out of many, one, becomes the reality of this nation. And we can make America truly great for the first time in a way it has never been. God bless you.
One last question before, I think this kind of ties into what you were just saying anyway. Mm. Just the last question before you can start signing some books. Can you talk about the five stages of racial grief?
Can you name them?
Yeah.
Let me see. Oh, thank you.
First one is amnesia.
Okay. You just forget and act like it didn't happen, right? You just completely have the luxury of not knowing. When I mentioned earlier Gore Vidal talking about living in the United States of amnesia, we catch a bad case of that. When did that happen? No, I didn't know that, right? Not knowing. A complete case of having been bereft of any memory of the horrors of what happened. And think about it. The textbook makers in Texas have a bad case of amnesia because they tried to wipe all that stuff out, all right?
Denial.
Denial is you know what happened, but you pretend it didn't. You know it went down like that, right? And people... So it's, amnesia is not even knowing. Denial is knowing and then pretending you don't know. Or saying, no, that's not how it occurred. You know, and when you, it wasn't me. You know that Shaggy song? I bet y'all do. I bet y'all do. It's like, it wasn't me. Like, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? Right? So that's a kind of racial phenomenon when it comes to denial. Denying the legit, you know, racism wasn't that bad. Bill O'Reilly, when Michelle Obama said that I wake up every day in a house built by slaves, she the coldest speaker in that family, really in America, right? Mm-hmm. Just one of the coldest, right? And she's saying that Bill O'Reilly, well, they were paid well. That's just denial. You just, well, that might be tripping, okay? That might be denial, and you tripping. But it's a kind of concerted denial.
Yes, sir. Appropriation.
Appropriation, you know what that is. If you can't beat them, you join them. You take somebody else's culture. And you pretend that, hey, it's all of our culture, you know. So you get, now there's a difference. There's a difference between, say, Eminem, who extends a tradition, right? Eminem's a genius from Detroit.
Yeah.
Recognize
8 Mile.
Recognize a real Don when you see one. I'm going back to Cali. Okay, had to hit the biggie for you, right? So Eminem is a genius. Iggy Azalea, not so much. What's up, Nick Young? So what's interesting is that Iggy Azalea appropriates the tenor, the tone, the sound, but can't match the genius, the innovation, the wizardry, right? So you appropriate the culture, or Marc Jacobs. Marc Jacobs takes those Etsy locks and multicolor, and when black people call him on it, he gets defensive. He goes as if everybody can't participate and everybody can't appropriate, and he says, you know, what about when black women get straight hair? Woo, don't mess with no black women in their hair now, man. I just want to give you one little piece of advice. Do not go there. It's unbelievable. Just leave it alone. Just leave it alone, homie. But check this out. Are you telling me that white women are only women with straight hair? I think some Latinas might disagree with that, and some Asian women might disagree too. So how have you appropriated white straight hair, follicular fidelity, as the characteristic aspect of white hair? Already you got a racist consciousness, or at least a racially driven one, and you're defensive when people are simply saying, did you see the other day it was reinforced in the courts that you can fire a black person for wearing locks to work?
Yeah.
Yes, that you can literally disqualify them for employment, but you as a white man can take it while they're working as a model and then use it and not understand your privilege. So that's the kind of appropriation that I think is profoundly destructive in the argument about race. Now, I'm giving you one more that's complicated. Justin Timberlake is an extremely talented guy. But Justin Timberlake, when it came to that Janet Jackson stuff, I'm not a Negro, I just play one on TV. Right? Remember that? Janet Jackson sold a nanosecond of her breast, her nipple. Right, I went to the bathroom, I missed it, I had to TiVo it to come back. What? What did I miss? Right? And then Janet got, now she winning, 50 years old with a baby, married to a billionaire from, you know, she winning, I ain't mad. But she got ostracized. You know, some other people have showed everything God gave them and more on tape, on film, when they had film, digital, right? And ain't got demonized at all. You see my point? And so now Justin Timberlake is interesting because he deals in an extraordinary fashion with extending the infinite varieties, not infinite, but the creative varieties of black expression, but he also appropriates that identity when it's good for him and when it's not good for him and when it costs him something, he distances himself. So that is a more complicated vision, but that's what I mean by appropriation. Whatever. Two more.
Revise or revisionist history.
Yeah, revise, you know, you just, you know what revisionist historiography is. Well, the Civil War was not fought over slavery. It was fought over states' rights. States' rights to do what? Own slaves! Did I miss something? I think that was the, so that's the most clear example of revisionist historiography that one might conjure.
And the last one is dilute.
Yeah, dilute the history in the sense it wasn't that bad. I mean, slavery was bad, but it didn't last that long. Other people, there were white people who were indentured slaves. So you dilute the reality of it, like, it's not that bad. You know, what we do with women, like, really, is it that bad? I mean, you make 70 cents on the dollar what a man makes. It's not really that. I mean, you're still working. So you dilute it because you want to distort the perception of the durability of the hurt and trauma that have been endured. And you want to dilute your own accountability in the process, collectively speaking. See, it's interesting to me that America says to people of color and to women and to others, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Do it on your own. And then when we turn around and say, but you stole, borrowed, and ripped everything else off that you wanted, and you didn't really do it on your own. Because if you were born to a woman and somebody changed your diaper, you're not self-made. And the reality is that there's a dilution of the intensity of the trauma that in this case, black and brown people have endured so that we can salve the wounds and the consciences of people who have benefited from that trauma. Because all of us, in a sense, benefit, right? It's like when you gentrify a neighborhood. you're not the you may not be deliberately trying to hurt and harm people, but the fact of your existence in that community means that some people have been pushed out. You know, I went to Starbucks tonight, thank God, but a Starbucks might come to the neighborhood so I could participate in a gentrification. When I said keep the team here, I mean, I'm not saying that Steph Curry shouldn't be in San Francisco. San Francisco, which gets a better reputation than it has earned.
Yeah.
In terms of diversity, real tricky up in the liberal white enclave where multiracialism and multiculturalism should ostensibly reign. And I'm saying in Oakland, with the vibrant consistency of multiracialism, that the Golden State Warriors might do more good in a city like Oakland, where the investment and pride in them is so fierce. But what do I know? What do I know? I'm just some dude who watches the stuff on TV. But being from Detroit and seeing what happens when there's the export of capital and that there's a marginalization. Dan Gilbert, who owns the Cleveland Cavaliers, also owns a lot of private property. Maybe the number one or number two private property owner in Detroit with essentially a private police force. I've met Dan Gilbert. He gives me love for being from Detroit. I respect that. But there's something deep and profound in terms of gentrification and dilution of these communities and of the story of how they are hurting the very people who are there, who are supposedly the beneficiaries of the change. Ask Brooklyn what happened when, you know, stadiums get established and people are displaced. Now, that's inevitable and unavoidable, and I'm trying to make an argument against expansion of opportunity, but it's always at the cost of somebody in some community, and we should be conscious of that. That's what I have in mind when
thank
I talk
you.
About dilution as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Mr. Dyson for this wonderful, informative, and entertaining evening. Thank you so much.
Have to have a multi-pronged effort, one in civil disobedience and the other in advocacy. And I think that hopefully we took the burden off the people in engaging in an act of civil disobedience, and now they can go full force and take action.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Confirmed, I will also faithfully observe.
Not Now, American Jews Against the Occupation. David Friedman, you promote racism, fund illegal settlements. We will not be silenced. You do not represent us, and you will never represent us.
Israeli occupation is an injustice against Palestinians and a moral crisis for American Jews. Moral American Jews stand against occupation and against Friedman. Moral American Jews stand against Friedman.
Senator, if you send this man to Israel, you endanger millions of Palestinians and Israelis. American Jews stand against this man. We stand for freedom and dignity for all. Olam chesed yibaneh.
Confirmed by the
Senate. Just continue with questions.
He is unqualified for this position. He is unqualified to be the U.S. ambassador to Israel. He finances the illegal settlers in the occupied West Bank.
Chairman Corker, Ranking Member Cardin, members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I appreciate very much the opportunity to appear before you today. It's a great privilege to address this committee, which has done so much to advance America's interests around the world.
Mr. Friedman also said that Palestinian refugees don't have a claim to the land, don't have a connection to Palestine, when in fact they do. Mr. Friedman, I'm right here. Mr. Friedman, my grandfather was exiled, was kicked out by the state of Israel, Mr. Friedman, and I'm right here, Mr. Friedman, holding up the Palestinian flag right behind you. We are going away, Mr. Friedman. We were there, we are there now, and we will always be there.
In Los Angeles this week, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Those were the voices of some of the protesters who on Thursday interrupted the Senate confirmation hearings of David Friedman, who could be the next U.S. ambassador to Israel. Friedman, an ardent Zionist who has a home in Talbiya, a neighborhood of West Jerusalem that was ethnically cleansed by Zionist forces in 1948, helped funnel tens of millions of dollars into the Bet El settlement colony in the occupied West Bank. He's called supporters of the liberal Zionist group J Street, quote, worse than capos, Jews who turned in their fellow Jews in the Nazi death camps. But as the Electronic Intifada points out, he has painted himself as a moderate. Joining us today are two of the activists who protested Friedman's hearing, Tahar Herzala of American Muslims for Palestine and Tali Ruskin of Jewish Voice for Peace and Code Pink. They're the last two voices you heard in those recordings. Tahar and Tali, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you, Nora.
So, Tahar, let's start with you. Tell us about your protest and why you did it.
Our protest obviously was targeted and aimed at David Friedman, but also really to the senators who are sitting on the Foreign Relations Committee to send a clear message that that youth, Palestinian and Jewish together, oppose and fervently reject the Zionist monopoly over American politics or American foreign policy, as well as the Zionist monopoly over the Jewish community and the Jewish community politics. And for me, it was very important to talk about my family history, to really center that in my protest, and I hopefully accomplished that goal.
And Tali, tell us about your action and why you're out there at the Senate confirmation hearing as well.
Great. Thanks, Nora, and thank you, Tahar. Well, I see this action as part of a huge campaign that many, many groups have been a part of to work to ensure that David Friedman not become the next U.S. ambassador to Israel. So many groups like JVP and Code Pink and AMP and countless others have been in the U.S. campaign for Palestinian rights, have been working tirelessly to make phone calls to senators and have meetings with senators to talk to them about why David Friedman would be such a terrible choice for the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to Israel. So I see this action as part of that larger campaign to be vocal in the room where the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is is hearing from Friedman about his what he believes to be his qualifications to be the ambassador. And many groups have said that he's not qualified. And I wanted to make sure to really voice that and bring voice to the fact that he's not qualified for this position. And furthermore, that he himself personally finances settlements and buildings within settlements. I mean, his name is featured on buildings throughout settlements in the occupied West Bank, and it would be dangerous and inappropriate for him to be the U.S. ambassador to Israel. So I wanted to really bring voice to that.
Now, Taher, you're no stranger to protests when a representative of Israeli policies is speaking. You were one of the Irvine 11 in 2010. You protested the speech of then Ambassador Michael Oren at UC Irvine. Can you talk a little bit about this continuation of protest and why it's so important to you to remain committed to doing this kind of action?
Yeah, I think that continuing or learning from my experience in Irvine 7 years ago, I felt that this form of protest was highly effective in getting the message across to not only those who are sitting in the audience and those who are the target of our message, but also those who are watching on TV or over video. And I think that it's very important for us in this era, in particular in the Trump era, that we recognize that this is the protest era, that we recognize that there's nothing normal about this and that we have to stand up and make a stand. And so for me, that this was a tactical decision. I think the group that was organizing, Tali headed the process of organizing this demonstration, and I'm fully grateful for that. And those from If Not Now and Kareem from AMP deliberately thought about what to do. And I think this was a very important strategic decision to protest in this way. And I'm still very, very committed to this type of protest and the efficiency of this type of protest and getting the word out and taking the mic when we typically don't have the mic ourselves.
And you both spent time in jail in Washington, D.C. After you were escorted out of the hearing room. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like and if charges are being filed against you?
So we were arrested immediately after the event. We were taken down to a police van, stuffed in there, and then driven to a, this command center, the Capitol Police Command Center, where we were jailed for several hours while being processed and booked. And I believe most of us got booked for unlawfully disrupting Congress or something of that sort. And so we are awaiting a court date, some of us are, to see if we will officially be charged by the prosecutor. But that we'll find that out on March 1st when some of us go to court.
So the court hearings are on March 1st. And Tali, does that apply to you as well?
Well, I was actually one of the later people who was being processed. So by the time they got to me, they somehow, I think they changed the charges. I'm not really sure what happened because there was a lot of commotion. But essentially, I was able to pay a fine of $35. And another person who was processed at the same time as me from If Not Now was able to pay a fine of $50. I'm not sure why we had different charges, but so we do not have a court date on March 1st.
Finally, both of you, Tahar, brought up the fact that this is the age of protest. What comes next?
You know, I think that one of the main reasons to do an action of this sort of civil disobedience and disruption during a Senate hearing is to get attention, but not for the sake just for the sake of getting attention, but this for the sake of using that attention to propel people to take further action. So next week, Congress will be on recess. So people's senators will be at home in their district offices. And so this is this is the time for folks to set up meetings with their senators in their local offices to tell them to vote against Friedman. This action is really to be used as a wake-up call, as, you know, sort of a flashy moment to get people to take action on this issue. Like I said, this action is part of a much larger campaign to ensure that David Friedman not become the U.S. ambassador to Israel. So I think that the next step is that we need to really leverage this moment to make sure that people voice their opposition to Friedman to their elected officials.
And Taher.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, as Tali said, this is hopefully a catalyst for people to move from being, bystanders to active participants. And I think this is what we're hoping for, is that people seriously take a look at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, see if their senator is on that committee, and immediately make phone calls. I mean, we do have to have a multi-pronged effort, one in civil disobedience and the other in advocacy. And I think that hopefully we took the burden off the people in engaging in an act of civil disobedience, and now they can go full force and take action in advocacy and calling and sending letters and meeting with their elected officials to reject the appointment of David Friedman. Absolutely.
All right. Well, Taher Herzella and Tali Ruskin, both of you, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you, Nora. And thank you so much, Taher.
Thank you all.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
That wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.